Testing. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Yeah, please.
Talking to you so far, let's see, Robert Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
Reverend Borders.
Yeah.
Thornton King's so very high lady, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Sam Michelle I spoke to.
Yeah.
And this week I'm trying to get in touch with John Calhoun and Grace Hamilton.
Yeah.
So, I'm moving along.
Well, you got some great people there.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a good bunch of interviews.
How is Borders? I haven't seen him in 18 months.
He's fine. A little slower moving than before, I guess, but he's...
He is?
He's going all right.
Is he all right? I mean, he and I both are getting old. I'm losing my line of thought occasionally. How about him? Does he talk in unceasingly?
He wanders around a little
bit. Does he? Yeah. Great old man.
Yeah, he is very nice fellow.
He used to say, shortest, he'd be making me say, the shortest distance to heaven is straight from Atlanta, Georgia.
That's exactly what he said.
Is that what he told you?
Right.
And, you know, I don't know whether he told you or not. If I remember the story correctly, in the early days of the race problem, probably in the late 50s or the early 60s, a young black Korean veteran. Did he tell you that story? Well, there's still controversy about the buses in those days. The buses had not, I don't think Miss Parks had made her move in Montgomery, but this young man had been in the war, and it was a beautiful Sunday morning, and he was riding the bus, and the congregation had gathered in front of Fleet Street, which was Borders' church, and I think Dr. Borders was standing out front in his clerical collar and robe. And this bus drove up there, and it wasn't but one person on it. That was a young Korean veteran in uniform. And the bus driver was white, redneck, probably. I'm not sure about that. But anyhow, he drove the bus up and stopped in front of the church there for him to get up. And the young man came to the front of the bus to get off, and he refused to let him off the front of the bus. And the crowd, evidently sensing what was happening, began to get upset. Boy refused, and the crowd began to move around the bus. Evidently, there were some words exchanged, and finally, the bus driver made the worst mistake he probably ever made in his life. He pulled a gun out. And, of course, what he didn't realize at that time was he couldn't get away either, but I guess he thought he could move the bus over people. And anyhow, one of those unfortunate things. And the old reverend, he saw what was happening, and so the story goes, he went to the back door of the bus and knocked on it. And the bus driver, evidently seeking some kind of relief, opened the back door, and Borders got on and told him to close the back door. He walked up front, told him, and he said, I don't want you to. You're absolutely right about whatever you told him. Anyhow, he placated him and got him to sit down and go on, get off the back of the bus, and then he had him a situation. And he opened the back door, and the young veteran got off the, swallowed his pride, went back like Borders had told him. Borders walked back after the door was closed, and that was the biggest work. He said, man, I don't know what he said, but the story is that he said that you want to live or die, it's your decision. And that if you do what I tell you, you can live. He said, that I'm going to make people pause. And you're going to drive this bus up the street a few feet. He said, if you do that, you're going to open the front door, and I'm going to get out the front door. Let him move the bus 100 feet up the street. And because the crowd were expected, Borders, they opened the front door, Borders stepped out the front door and yelled to him, said, everything's all right.
That's a tense situation.
Oh, yeah. Those kind of things could blow in a minute. Well, a lot of them.
I want the
I want this to first get back to the 1969 election, and then just sort of move back from there, which you weren't in, but I was curious about some things involving the 69 mayoral election.
Yeah.
Okay, up to apparently 1969, from what I've read, there was a coalition of Northside whites and blacks in politics that stuck together. More or less.
Yeah. I think that's, Mr. Hartsfield had received a large percentage of black vote,
mm-hmm.
and, I had received, of course, I was running against Mr. Maddox, and that pretty well assured me of 100% of the black vote.
Right.
But that is correct. They had done a coalition. It was not any structured coalition. It was just a coalition.
Okay. Was it possible for, say, the black leaders to overrule the choice of a certain white candidate if they didn't care for that person?
Well, up until that time, that had never been an issue. Mm-hmm. In the 69 election, the black community selected Mansell, who was a white candidate. Mm-hmm. And the civic group, which was the North Side, back to Rodney Cook, they did advise me,
mm-hmm.
in a meeting early in the year that they were going to support Massaro.
Why Massaro? Why Massaro, for example, rather than Horace Tate, who was obviously.
Well, Horace Tate had not come into it at that time. The picture was, you see, when we get to drawing conclusions, I mean simple conclusions, and that this is my fault, I frequently do this, those were not the circumstances. When the early part of that election started, other than Stokes, perhaps, in Cleveland, which was a city that was completely dominated by the black community, because most of the whites had moved out of Cleveland. But the black community, in the early part of that election, were not cognizant of the fact of how much influence they had. And they did not attempt in the beginning to select a black candidate to run.
So Horace Tate was doing it on his own then?
Horace Tate kind of slid into it sideways, as I remember.
Mm-hmm.
There were a large number of candidates, and he did not go into it with the support and never did get the strong support of the black community in Atlanta, I don't think.
So I guess the sense of it then was that a black could not yet win in 1969.
That is correct. That is correct. Although I guess it was that year, 69, when Maynard did win,
right.
Vice mayor.
So I guess in a sense, Marcel was really a transitional figure. I suppose, because the next election, Jackson did win.
That is correct.
I was also curious about a racial factor as sort of an underlying issue in many decisions and events. And first of all, your 1961 win over Maddox, was that very much an election dealing with the racial factors? Were racial factors very prominent in that election?
Very much so. The race issue was reaching its highest point of heat,
mm-hmm.
at that time. I mean, the civil rights movement per se was coming into the whole picture and of course would dominate nearly every decision for the next 4 or 5 years after that.
Mm-hmm.
until passage of the Civil Rights Bill and voting acts and all those things tended to take care of the situation. But at that point, the issue was very, very strong. It was almost always prevalent, and sometimes bordered on violence.
I noticed in the 1961 campaign, you became the first white politician to publicize your meetings with blacks, which had never been done before.
I had made that statement and put it in that book.
Right, I read it first.
Without ever having it contradicted, and I guess what caused me to do it was that there had always been apparently a common understanding amongst the white candidates that they would not feature their efforts to solicit the black vote, particularly their schedules where they were going. We were making many and many appearances in the community houses, which were the black churches. Nearly every night there was a meeting in some black church in which most of the candidates were there, and then some of the schools, Washington High School, I remember, was one of them. And we showed up out there, and of course Maddox was not, he would not come to teach. And that night, maybe Maddox did show up that night. I'm confused in my own mind exactly how it happened, but someone tried to question the candidates that were there the issue of whether it was going to be made public or not. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that two of the candidates that were in the race quietly, while we were still on the podium, slipped off the podium and got away and went out. And I realized that it was an issue that Maddox was going to make a big thing out of. This was my personal thing about it was, and that the sooner we got it out in the open, the better off we could be. And I remember I went back that night and told Helen Bullard that from then on my schedule was going to be published everywhere out, regardless of where it was. And she said, well, that hadn't been the custom. I said, okay, well, customer, I'm not going to defend it. I'm trying to bring it out in the open because I don't think it'll be an issue. And after we brought it out in the open, after I said, yes, I was there, were you there? I mean, the fuse went out of it entirely.
Good move.
Yes, it worked out all right.
Okay, another thing, in the Harold Martin book on Hartsfield, he mentioned that there was a bond issue in 1961 to build a cultural center in Piedmont Park. And he said that failed when Northside realtors spread the word that this would result in an incursion of blacks into the Northside. Is there anything about that at all?
Oh, Lord, you know, it's not bond issue.
Okay.
And that was a bond issue. That was a bond issue in which an anonymous Woodruff efforts in those days, everything was done anonymously. Mr. Woodruff had come by my house early in the spring and brought me a letter from one of the banks in Atlanta to make it official, and it was the Farmers Foundation to make a grant of $4 million. And these were big funds, then buildings at Georgia Tech didn't cost $4 million. But anyhow, it would be a gift, a foundation would make a gift of $4 million that the city and county would equally participate in, raise the same amount of funds in the bond issue. And so a good part of the bond issue was for about $80 million, but Piedmont Park, the south, we were going to use the southwest corner
East Coast to Piedmont Park, Southwest Coast to Piedmont Park to build a cultural. So the similar, the general idea was Tivoli Gardens in Copenhagen, something of that type. And they jumped on it, and generally, most people think that it was the bond issue was defeated on the basis that this money was being used to develop Piedmont Park for black residential, to move them into that area, and particularly to integrate the park. Park was already integrated legally, but they did, and it probably helped to see some bond issues. And later had to take that out and come back in and pass the bond issue.
So the thought was that not only blacks use the park, but build housing in the area.
Yeah, but sometimes those things get fully expressed. Not probably fully expressed, but the real issue was that you just want to bring the blacks in the Piedmont Park.
Another thing in your book that you mentioned, that the racial issues partly delayed construction of the stadium in the early 60s. Do you remember that at all? There was just one reference to it in your book.
I don't know. That must be.
Well, I don't have the page number. Mm-hmm. I don't have the exact page number, but it was something about the construction of the stadium and being partly delayed due to racial issues. I'm not sure. I wasn't sure what you meant by that exactly. Okay, I was also wondering about the MARTA rail line. Apparently the blacks didn't support the first bond issue on that, and I was curious how they were won over to supporting putting a rail line. Did it have anything to do with the fact that they were promised the rail line in the west side neighborhoods first?
No. As we went through the throes of starting the development of the rapid transit system, there were innumerable major steps they had to take to bring it down to a point of financing. Because the key to the whole thing was the fact that the federal government was gradually developing huge sums of money for the purpose. Now this is where the Williams Bill was the key to rapid transit, and as it developed in the early 60s, the real possibility of building a system came into view. We had to create MARTA, which we did in the first meeting of the board hall with a technical accident. We had to get it adopted by the state government to grant it the power. We had to pass a statewide constitutional amendment in order to have the rights, all of which takes time as you go along. And we look back over the 20-odd years before we actually got, we always knew that we were on precarious grounds of the city's share of the financing, which in those days, I think, 20%. would have to come from ad valorem taxes. There was no, the state had not granted the right of sales tax anywhere. But the state also realized they had to put up 10% to justify it. And that was where these were the many things came in. The first effort, the first referendum, which was a bond issue referendum, the Bill Marder, we knew was on hazardous ground, but the theory was, even if you lose it the first time, that may be necessary to lose it once in order to pass it. It takes this time to educate the public. The public to, after this. Voted on it and beat it, and then they had another time to realize how badly they needed it, and these things changed. But we had the first referendum, I think, in 68 or 69, somewhere along there. It had taken us 7 years to bring it to that point. And we had the best leadership in the city, wasn't it? Dick Rich headed it up, Ralston Havity headed it up. It was a model thing. Then it came down when we didn't get but about 48% to 46% for it. But that was an indication that we had a chance. But then the clever thing came along with Senator Leroy Johnson, who is today a permanent black man. I guess he's still in the state legislature. Leroy, who had sponsored Bassell, he was the man that put Bassell in office. Senator Johnson conceived of the idea, I give him credit for what my understanding was, that the state would give us a 1 cent sales tax privilege because that would then relieve the state of making contributions proceed a mod, I mean, and all this. But the main thing you would do was, if you could get a 1 cent sales tax through, then you wouldn't have to go, you wouldn't have to vote an overall ad valorem increase, which is the hardest thing to go, because that's when you have a tax burden already is. But a 1 cent sales tax would come also from the people who would use it as well as from everyone else. And all this went into it, and he was the man that conceived the idea and put the 1 cent sales tax to, and that's what enthused the black community, because he promised them a 10 cent fare for 10 years. So he just gave them the greatest bargain anybody ever had, and that was a 1 cent sales tax, but it didn't seem like much.
But there wasn't any promise.
Put it in the West Side as a way of winning black support.
Oh, that was that was no bigger than it had to always had to run north, south, east, west. Because I remember that never was any. It was an issue, but the main thing was you got the sales tax, and the black people got Johnson's idea of passing the sales tax by guaranteeing the 10 cent fare is what swept everything else. It put them on. They knew they were buying the best bargain, and he could sell, and they sold that. And they got 100% black support in the referendum.
So the Wool affair was a factor then?
Yeah.
How about the 1966 Sandy Springs annexation vote? Did that have a racial aspect to it?
In every way, yeah. Particularly in the area of schools. Oh, yeah, that was, we just got clobbered with race issue. Any time we tried to, and there were several different times we tried to make moves to the expansion of the city, and the race issue just common. So no question about that.
Would you also say in terms of ever developing a regional government that the race issue was a factor there too?
Man, you couldn't get it through to save yourself.
But why? Is it
the race issue? Sure. Yeah, those that are inside and got the power inside don't want it, and those that are outside sure don't want it.
That's the way it seemed to me too.
Oh, and no question about it. And you have to realize that a lot of these people that
fellows outside were forced to move. Oh, of course, they moved themselves because of the black people moving in. You see, the whole west side of Atlanta was white. It was the low-income group, the west side. And as the black people moved in and more and more came in, and in those days the city was getting some growth, which it hadn't had in recent years, they were pushing these people out. Thousands of people moved off of the west side into Cobb County and into Douglas County. And as far as other boys, it's one of those things that there's just no way. You have to face the fact that they're extremely bitter about it. Because in the olden days, they used to say they were losing their home and everything had got all their investment, but they didn't lose it. The black man always had to pay more for the land than the boy. No question about that.
But basically, these people who were moving out did not want to be back in the city where the blacks are the majority, or still had a great deal of power, I suppose.
That's right. No, they don't. And for, this was particularly true of the schools.
The schools have to emerge, I guess.
That's right. Yeah. Oh, God.
See, I can't understand. It's a rookie issue. Another thing I was curious about, Atlanta's moderate handling of the racial issues during the 60s, and your particular testimony in favor of the 64 Civil Rights Act. I was curious, did that lead to any special allocations of funds from the federal government in terms of urban renewal, model cities? In other words, you obviously did a splendid thing in terms of being the only Southern mayor to support.
Unconsciously, in the beginning, I didn't, my testimony before the Senate Commerce Committee was not predicated on that, nor did they ever give talk about my feelings about civil rights and public accommodations. I had changed my own views and come a very long way. Mm-hmm. At some point, sitting in the mayor's office, I did realize that all of the big money that was coming to Atlanta had come to Atlanta, which was, had been contrary to what the state ever did. Low-income housing in which you rebuilt housing for 10% of the population of the city, 40,000 people, they were magnificent units, and I don't care what anybody said. Through the years, they've been exceptions, but they have served nobly to raise the level of the people that were there. God knows they needed it. They had no education. The expressway system was all federal money. We were beginning to get urban renewal was all federal money. All the big money that had been coming to the city, been coming to federal government at the same time. The cities were just raising hell with the federal government about anything and how it is, all because they had to conform to certain patterns of families with regards to black people. And they, everybody in the South was just damning the federal government. And I just, as plain, common, hard sense, realized that, and maybe I was guided by a fellow named Lee from New Haven. He was mayor, and I had talked to him the other year, and he had just milked the federal government dry getting money to rebuild New Haven. And I realized that I had the position, either my civil rights position or public accommodation, those kind of things. I had the attention in Washington. And I didn't stand in the room and well, I should milk that thing dry too.
You definitely think benefits came from the city because of your standing.
Man, we were the first to get huge funds in modern cities. We were the first to get funds in economic opportunity. We just pumped the federal money in here. We built more low-income housing than had ever been built before. We remodeled more neighborhoods. We got all we had to do was put out our hand, and Uncle Sam gave us the money.
I guess most people didn't realize that your testimony would be so beneficial.
Well, it wasn't. From then on, I became the champion of the government. every time I made a talk with anyone else, I told them Atlanta was, boy, we were begging to get that. You know, even governments like to have money for themselves.
Oh, sure.
And I was the guy in the South that was saying nice things about him. Yeah, I got brought Dan Sweat in. He was an able young man just for that purpose. He was out in the DeKalb County, and he headed up the city's efforts to get together a fund. Man, he got more money, better money than anybody's ever seen. We've been living off of it ever since.
How about in terms of other benefits? Let's say getting a baseball team. Was that at all a product of...
No, it was all a product of the civic community.
Okay, in terms of putting a major league team here, where whites and blacks would have to play together and sit in the stands together, I mean, obviously you needed a public accommodation Civil Rights Act. If the 64 Act was not passed, would the Braves ever come here? Or would conventions still be coming here?
Well, that had been a great block up until that time. But all of this was coming together. We had integrated baseball in Old Park Glen Park. I thought they were going to all walk out before we built, but that was not an issue in the building of the stadium. And in major, there was never, everything in Atlanta was sweet and honey and apple pie when the Braves came here as far as race relations. I'm talking about, on overall, there were some underlying things like Henry Irvin's wife, who damn near turned the city upside down.
Was she white?
No, she was black. She was just hard to handle. We had several major racial incidents in which there were 1,000 people white and 1,000 people black, all who wanted to swear that they had seen the same incident, and they had opposite views on it. It was just the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. But those kind of things still happen, because, you know, the old spirit of segregation on racism, even today, you get to play out.
How about in terms of bringing more business conventions to the city? Do you think the integration of Augusta and
was absolutely necessary and was helpful. But the big thing about bringing conventions to the city was start getting some new public facilities. It's the stadium and the Coliseum and the Civic Center and then the new hotels.
Right.
The new hotels, in the beginning, most of them came out of the urban rural areas. See?
So in a sense, you were still benefiting from that support you get with that organization. I'm also curious about whether black leaders had any major voice in the administration on various decisions. For example, choosing new sites, or where to build public housing. Did you consult with the black community on these issues?
There were not a lot of blacks in position. All this was new. It didn't happen overnight. I never reached the point of appointing a black head of any of the city departments. We increased black employment. It did not reach that point. I brought Mrs. Grace Hamilton in the country. She came in over there in charge of certain community affairs.
But let's say in terms of economic decisions like renewal sites or public housing, did you consult with King Sr. or Remy Waters or any of the people that were leaders?
The city worked very closely with Dr. Bordas, and I personally worked with him over getting necessary city aid on the development of the Hoot Street area over there. Yes, he was he was given full support and every consideration. It was a new board. I mean, it was a new mold for the first time the black man could sit at the head table. He was participating in decisions of that kind, but had not yet reached the point of being appointed as head of any city department.
I noticed quite often that blacks were very upset about all the public housing being placed on the west side. Was there any kind of any reason for that being done?
Well, that's quite true, and that was becoming more and more of an issue as time went on, and we began to look for different sites. Of course, the feeling had always been that you use this low-income housing to clear up slum areas, to purchase slum areas, and to build it where there was slum, rebuild those areas. This began to become a heated point, yes. An issue.
But nonetheless, the housing pretty much went to the west side, didn't it?
Yeah, what?
The public housing still went to the west side. It's still being built on the west side.
A good deal of it. Most of it, yeah.
Was there any thought of the public housing or, let's say, highways being used as buffers between the races at all?
I don't recall that being an issue.
I was also curious whether the pressure generated in Atlanta by the civil rights movement was more effective here, let's say, than, for example, Birmingham, because of the political power blacks had in Atlanta, and also because of this long tradition of cooperation between the races. Was there any feeling that civil rights was more workable here, and black groups had more of an influence here because
of... Well, we were way ahead of attitude. And Alabama, Georgia was not as anywhere near as factored as Alabama was.
Mm-hmm.
And Atlanta was certainly far ahead. I've always attributed to the fact that you had a very articulate, educated, intelligent group of black leadership. And you had these sixth grade colleges and university out here. Who were the main thrust in America of high education for black people. And although they were extremely restricted in graduates and jobs they could get into, they had stayed here, a lot of them. And they had acquired some good governmental jobs, particularly in the teaching profession. They knew most of the highly able black leadership of America at that point was coming out of Atlanta, Georgia. Whitney Young, Martin Luther King Jr., William Holden Carter. You can just see them. I can't recall all the names, but most of them. Plus the fact that you had a substantial Negro business community. That was reasonably successful. You had the bank, Citizens Trust of the bank, you had Atlanta Life Insurance Company, you had Meach Milton drugstore chain, you had a West Side business area which was built around Pascal Brothers out there. Yes, you had a lot of things in Atlanta that you didn't have in Birmingham. In Birmingham, you just had poor devils that were being ground under the feet.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, I guess it was easier to deal with the black community race if many of them were, at least the leadership was affluent and they were educated.
Well, two ways. I think you got that. The degree of ability and capability of these people was way ahead of what you would find in other sections of the country. You didn't have it in New York, you didn't have it in Philadelphia, where you had these huge black communities. They had people
Atlanta had had an established Negro community that was asserting itself, that was more capable of asserting itself in a nonviolent fashion than other sections of the country.
Well, in terms of the nonviolence of this, would you attribute that, for example, to the fact that there had been a long period, long tradition of talking to blacks?
Sure.
And cooperation,
no question
to solve problems?
No question about it. And that leadership surfaced, began to expand and surface very rapidly as they had an opportunity to it was just all the difference in the world, no question about that.
That's interesting. Okay, a few other points I wanted to raise. The school closings, or possibility of school closings back in 61. What effect do you think that would have had on the city?
Well, I think it would have been a disaster. I think most people agree that you just can't give up, sacrifice public education. That was what the whole effort in the state was to hide behind the ground. Every effort was made to have an issue in Atlanta, you know, because this was a big city, and all this massive anti-integration legislation that was passed by the state, books of segregated laws, they were all aimed at having this thing happen in Atlanta. And let them pay the price. That's where all these smart black people are. Except they didn't call them black people. So.
Do you think Atlantans at that time were watching very carefully what was happening in Little Rock or Birmingham in terms of not wanting that?
The civic leadership in the city, which is, of course, asserting itself more and more and accepting more and more responsibility, knew what was happening.
And we're concerned about it.
No question about it.
Okay, another point. In your 1969 State of the City Address, you said, this is the quote from you, that the status of the Negro citizens was Atlanta's number one problem. I was curious in what way you meant that as a 69 State of the City Address.
You know, That was said in reference to the condition that he was in at that time, that he had not had education. As a whole, he had not had education. Mm-hmm. Thousands of black people had moved in here from rural Georgia and had no education, had no home ownership, had no family background, had no church connection. They didn't have any of the stability. And this great flux of people in a place for them is still a great problem today. Unemployment and jobs and all these things were coming flood tide that something had to be done about. Both the Negro citizen, his needs, and the issue itself of the conflicts that it was creating as all this change was coming about made the Negro citizen the number one problem.
In other words, unless the blacks are brought up to a level, decent level, and there's better race relations, that the city's going to fall apart at some point. Is that what you're really saying?
I think that's what I was saying, yeah.
I also wanted to mention something else that you've already sort of explained away in your book, but I was curious again about the infamous or famous Peyton Road barrier that pops up.
Sure. Well, that was one of several bad mistakes I made. No question about that. I got led down a Primrose path, and I should have had enough sense not to. It was in the first year I was in office. And I had gone overboard in a number of instances to try to work out problems for the black community. And this was a
major issue out there that looked like it could be controlled and make everybody happy, because on the north side of the Peyton Road barrier was close to 400 acres of vacant land that had been artificially and maliciously zoned in order to prevent black housing on it. It was a zone for industry, and I was led to believe that we could work out, that we could take care of the white people down there, and that we could then, by doing this, get them, if we did this, we could get them to agree to rezone and open up this land. I really thought we were going to make a beneficial trade out of it. What I didn't know was, what I should have realized was, you can't, there's no Solomon's around.
I spoke to Cecil Alexander, Dr. Sosoy.
Who?
Cecil Alexander.
Yeah.
And he said it was not so much to keep blacks out, but to make whites feel secure in their own neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty much it, I guess.
That's right.
Okay. What impact do you think it had on blacks then?
I knew the flood tide was pouring, and I should have had enough judgment, or shouldn't have listened to the people that, you know, that were advising on it. And I guess there were people following their own net, and I thought it would work out satisfactorily for everyone.
In terms of those transitional white neighbors, just neighbors on the south side that were moving from white to black, was there any effort made at all to keep them integrated? Was that a government policy at all? Or was it assumed that some neighbors would have to be white and some black? And so you didn't do anything?
Well, I'd have to, I don't know that I can. There were dozens of instances of transitional areas developed. A block that would be solid white, a black family would buy a house in it. And then the thing would just be haywire. And then frequently they ended up with a delegation of strong, fine, able white people demanding what the city was going to do about it. Well, there wasn't a damn thing the city could do about it. And it took a lot of courage to have to stand there and tell them. I've had good men stand right in front of me, tower over the desk and say, God damn, I fought in the war and I'm not going to put up with this. And God damn, they just used to eat you up. I mean, the transitional neighborhoods were coming so fast. Everybody was running, I guess, or everybody, there was always somebody in the block that went to one. The minute one block went, another block went.
And you had a concern about violence or something?
Yes, there was violence. But there'd been, all kind of, still been black families that had been bombed out. Mm-hmm.
Was there any effort to convince the whites to stay or anybody?
All kind of meetings. Yeah. All kind of community relations meetings and everything. And meetings. And within the block themselves, everybody would band together, agree that they weren't going to move or anything. But none of them held that back then. It was just an irresistible tide that swept through. You had to face it. And the Peyton Road thing was, in that particular instance, there was a very appealing group of young white people that had built in that Peyton Road area down there on one side. And it looked like a good solution. Wasn't no hurting about it, we thought. But oh boy, what a mistake it was.
Okay, just two other things. The 1973 mayor's election. Was there white business community support for Leon Jackson at that point?
I can't answer that question. I don't know how much there was. There was some, yes. But usually would have been, I think that there were a number of them. I think, and I'm not positive about this, but I think there were a number of Jewish families that people that did support. As a whole, it was not a great deal of support. I refused to enter into the race. Either way, stayed out of it.
I'm just curious whether the business leadership here saw the handwriting on the wall that Black was now going to be elected mayor and would they support the election.
Well, there have been innumerable times when we have known that and then have gone against our better judgment thinking that there was some way to worm around it. But I mean, that never has been beaten. Mm-hmm. That was what we tried to do with Mansell's election. We felt we could get Cook elected, and we never could. It hadn't been a time, you go back, there was a vice mayor named Lee Evans who tried to run an anti-Black campaign to get re-elected vice mayor. He got beat. Sam beat. We take it down through the years. Every time anybody has tried to run an anti-Black campaign, so far back as I can remember, he got defeated.
Why is that?
Well, because it was they were the swing vote. Mm-hmm. There was always a split within the white group, but as long as you had white candidates. But then by the time they came in and had Black candidates, they were the predominant. They had the most votes, that's all.
Okay, but in the earlier period, I guess they were the swing vote, for example, the Hartsfield administration, I suppose.
He got it 100% against the... I can't remember. If you go back and look at the records, you'll find out that the last time he ran, Archie Ranger, mm-hmm. the county commissioner. He had to get the Black vote up almost 100%. Lindsay got more white votes than he did. He said, not at Plains, he got more white votes than I got. Mm-hmm. Oh, I beat him very badly, but I think he and I split the white vote.
So the Black vote became very important, I guess after 1946, when the white primary was won.
Yeah, 48, I believe, was when they eliminated the Democratic White primary. Of course, eliminating it and then getting it into full swing, there wasn't many Blacks, there weren't as many Blacks registered prior to that. And you had a lot of other things that entered into it and getting them registered and voted, but they came along very fast. Mm-hmm. No question about it.
Okay, and the only other thing I wanted to ask was whether you have any information on other subcontracts that would be.
Well, you've got some very fine people there. I'm particularly Harold Mays Hamilton and Reverend Borders, and Thompson was a good man too. He was in housing, as I remember, federal housing at my state. What's his first name? Ralph? Bob Thompson.
Well, I guess somebody like Dan Swift should be on the list.
Dan Swift would be excellent.
Mm-hmm. Give it a address on him?
Yeah. Central Atlanta Progress. Black leadership.
Well, Warren Cochran is the only other one I've really.
Well, he's gone, man. Is he still around?
Oh, yeah.
Warren is around. Yeah. He was an excellent man. He was a good man. He was a quiet
leader, but
he had a great deal of. Very impact on the black community. He just had a Butler Street line. That was the main meeting place. The old Hunger Club was where black problems were talked about. I guess it's still in operation, but it's nowhere near. But I mean, you know, you got so many black people that are in those kind of things now. Coming so fast.
Well, I want to eventually speak to Jesse Hill and Kelvin Russell, but they're hard to catch.
I expect they are, and the demands on their time are very good. I mean, they're too close to them. They just don't have time. I know Sir Jesse Hill stays alive. He must be on 15 major coffee boards on there.
I'm going to try, but I don't think I'm going to get a chance to talk to anyone.
You couldn't keep Jesse still 15 minutes, and he didn't sit still in 10 minutes. He's a great guy. I love him. I phoned him on everything that he knows. He taught me a few lessons, too. I had to learn a lot. I had to learn fast from black people.
Well, so did a lot of people. Any mm-hmm. place, I guess. I mean, there was a big change for everybody, north mm-hmm. and south, during that time.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Well, thanks very much.
Well, I'm glad to talk to you.
Well, I appreciate you giving